Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten. And on today's episode, we're talking about life after Jurgen Klopp. What's next for Liverpool?
They're losing Klopp, obviously. They're at risk of losing Salah. They're at risk of losing Van Dijk. And then that doesn't even cover the fact that they still have all the issues they have this season with, you know, no defensive midfielder. They've got questionable depth at centre-back. All of this is coming kind of into this perfect storm of uncertainty.
Then we bring you the burn book. I see so many people there like, get ready with me. And I'm like, that's a hoodie and trousers. And the fact that hoodie was like 150 quid doesn't make this a fit. You're just wearing Sambas and jeans and a hoodie. Like, go the fuck away. While over on the subscription side, we're talking Chelsea and whether Mauricio Pochettino has run out of road. The question can't just be, are we going to sack Pochettino? It has to be, who are we going to sack him for?
Sure.
And I don't think they will just do it in the knee-jerk ways. But those rumours are worrying. You know, rumours about Fernandes wanting to leave. The Athletic saying what you were saying about tactical instruction. Some of these players apparently expressing regret about their long-term contracts. You know, this is not what you hear from a club where things are going swimmingly. Before returning to Am I the Arsehole? A subject for which we are uniquely qualified. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another couple of episodes, and I'm joined by Pete Dorman, as always. How are you, Pete?
Hello, I'm very well. I imagine more rested than you, given the arrival of your new baby daughter. Congratulations, by the way. This is the first time I've actually spoken to you technically face-to-face, even though we're separated by a screen. But yeah, congratulations on the arrival of your new little daughter. How are things with you?
Thank you. They're okay. Like, the sleep deprivation is not bad. I mean, obviously as well, because I can't breastfeed. Like,
sure.
In a way, you get an easier ride at the beginning as a man, because, you know, you can't handle all the feeds.
Does that make you feel like less of a use, like a spare part?
Yeah, of course. But also, you know, obviously there are benefits to being less useful in that you sleep more. So then I take the baby a bit more in the day so Emma can sleep. But it's okay. I would say that the going from outnumbering your children to being, you know, perfectly matched in numbers,
you're
if not
one
in
on the back,
upper body strength,
is
like undesirable. It makes life difficult.
Yeah, you're like, you're absolutely one-on-one, you're exposed.
Yeah, and sometimes you're like, you know, sometimes you think, oh, okay, well, this one's got like more muscle mass, but this one's got like more skill in kind of close combat techniques. So you're always kind of like, which one is pissed off, which one needs to shit, like, you know.
And also, I imagine certain scenarios call for like a two-on-one scenario, which then means that what do you do with the other one? How do you manage that?
That is a very good question. How do you manage that? It turns out, Pete, there's no good solution. It turns out that the way you manage that is you try really, really hard and you spend like the whole weekend trying so hard. And at the end of the weekend, everyone's miserable and you're tired.
It turns out having children is really, really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. It is great. It's nice to have two. Like, we are actually having a pretty good time. But sometimes you're like, oh, so the one that I wasn't worried about is very unhappy and is also potentially sick at the same time. And am I getting sick? You know, you're like, oh, okay. I like it. It's like when you're kind of like, oh, God. You know, on The Witcher, I was having a good time. And then a friend said, you know what? Why don't you just put up the difficulty level? So I did put up the difficulty level and it made it more fun. I would say that that does not apply in this circumstance.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. I previously used to just really like it, not easy, but like I wanted my ego brushed. I wanted to not have that difficult a time. And then I started playing Elden Ring and there's no difficulty setting on that. It's just, that's just the game.
You just
work with it. And it took me a while to get into it. But once I did, it felt far more rewarding and I enjoyed it more because of that. But interestingly, on The Witcher, completely out of left field, do you know who's just started playing The Witcher for the first time?
Jess.
Jess.
We have very few mutual friends, yeah, sure. So it's like Jess, Olivia.
Yeah, so she played Hogwarts Legacy, and that was, I think that's about it that she's played since she was a child. But she was just like, I want to play a PlayStation game. What would you recommend? Like an open world game. And I recommended The Witcher or Red Dead 2. And she said she wanted like of the fantasy of The Witcher. And I was like, great game. And I'm quite envious of the fact that she's getting to play it for the first time again. You know, it's like when you give someone a recommendation of like a TV series or a book or film or a game, and you're like, I remember how much I loved this for the first time, but you can never get it back. So yeah, so she's she's done it like most nights this week as well. It's like, it's weird seeing her get into something like that, because it's...
I think it doesn't seem like it chimes with who she is. Yeah. But I mean, the thing is with The Witcher as well, like at the beginning, I was really struggling to get into it. And then once I got through that, I was like on it. I wanted to play it all the time.
Yeah.
And then I had, and then I basically stopped a couple of weeks before the baby was born because I'm quite close to the end. And it's kind of what you're saying, like the enjoyment of the beginning, like the open world feels really open at the beginning. Yeah. And then obviously as time goes on and you complete more of the quest and you complete more of like the side missions and more of the map like opens up, you're kind of like, the open world is not as open anymore.
Yeah.
So now
you've also
kind of
traversed
like,
most of it multiple times and you're like, oh, I'm back here again.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's less new, and then there's just less stuff to do as well. Or all the stuff you've done is pretty much the same as what you've done before, or you're doing.
Yeah, and I mean...
But are you saving it because you don't want it to end? Because I've done that before.
A little bit, but also my enthusiasm waned a little bit when I was closer to the end, because I was just like, I enjoy the story to some degree.
Sure.
But when I, but also it feels a little bit like when you get to a story beat, you're like locked in. And it's like, now you have to complete this level. Now you have to... play as this person and then like move on to this point, and it just feels less fun at the beginning. Like I kind of liked it at the beginning when I was massively underpowered and I would just come across things that like took me forever to kill, that I was just like shooting with an arrow from miles away until I could actually try and kill them, you know, like stuff like that. I was just like, it has an element of the unknown to it, and like it feels like it's full of possibility, and as time goes on you do just think, yes, now I have fought this person, and they're like, you should go and fight this person. I'm like, yeah, okay, right, sure. You know, it just feels a bit more by the numbers.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I get that.
I'm not trying to get, you know, a to-do list in a video game. Oh, I'm about to take possession of a baby. Okay. I've been handed a baby.
It's a very, very small baby.
She is really small. It's a major design flaw, to be honest. Okay.
So, but for the first time, the podcast has three hosts.
I mean, she's not really pulling her weight. She's not that different from you in that regard.
Yeah, sure, sure. And, well, I mean, Olivia Dodd never pulled her weight and the game's gone mad, so we're all right there.
And I would say they're probably... They didn't actually measure the baby's length in the hospital, but I can't imagine there's that much difference between her and Olivia.
No.
But obviously in suppleness of skin and all the other signs of age.
Like, I'm pretty sure she wears lifts as well.
All right, shall we move on to the topic in hand? Because I must say, it would have been better to do the podcast last week, because obviously, huge news in that Jurgen Klopp is leaving Liverpool at the end of the season. And it really does feel like it's the biggest event in the Premier League since Wenger left, I would say.
Yeah, probably.
I'm trying to think of one that's like similar scale. Abramovich selling, maybe. So, I mean, look, the Jurgen Klopp thing, like... there's a part of me when it happened, when I saw this news, that was kind of just relieved. I was just like, obviously Arsenal were about to play Liverpool at the time, but I thought, great, we never have to do this again. Because really, the last decade, despite the fact they've only won the league once, obviously the last decade has been dominated by Pep and Klopp. And not just in the Premier League, like I would say that their tactical innovations have really changed the landscape of football. Like now... inverted fullbacks, for example, are just a common part of the game. Like you see all sorts of teams doing those, and you think, well, that kind of came from, you know, it wasn't like totally original to them, but that came from Pep at Bayern and then at City, and of course Trent Alexander-Arnold at Liverpool. And even stuff like, you know, a few years ago we were talking about the idea of the center forward being dead, and then Liverpool and then City win the treble last season with the center with a conventional center forward. But it's interesting to imagine what the league is going to be like without Klopp, and whether he goes and works somewhere else and what that looks like. But what Liverpool look like without Klopp is truly impossible to predict. A few years ago, we'd have said Liverpool have the best backroom structure in the game.
Yeah.
They've got an amazing manager, and when he leaves, they'll have somebody lined up. Like, Liverpool do seem to have everything in order to continue to dominate. And now the squad is in a transitional moment, and not just in between, you know, the last generation of players and the next generation of players, but in between styles. Mm-hmm. They've had a bunch of backroom staff leave, and their recruitment has quite radically changed, and they are no longer clearly in the top two teams in the Premier League or in Europe. It's much more complicated than it used to be. So, Pete, what's your kind of reaction to the situation? What do you think the lie of the land is at Liverpool?
I think it's quite hard to tell, because I think for the most part, people just didn't see this coming. I think they saw it coming down the line, maybe 2-3 seasons away, but for him to come out when he did and just say, you know what, I'm kind of done at the end of the season. And I think he told the club in November, or he was discussing it at the club in November.
That's what
and
he
then
said. Yeah.
He has kind of made the decision and said that he wanted to control the narrative, and he wanted to be the person to tell everyone and not have it like trickle down through Chinese whispers. And I think that's fair enough. But part of the biggest problem with it from a Liverpool perspective is that it was kind of out of the blue, and they haven't really had the chance, like a year or two, to start to really plan this transitional period. Because like you say, nothing this big has really happened since Wenger. And historically, when a manager as successful and as big and as kind of autonomous within a club as Klopp leaves, generally things are quite difficult for a few years. You know, post-Wenger Arsenal are only now getting to a stage where they're one of the better clubs in Europe and one of the best clubs in the league. Post-Ferguson United are still struggling as a middling top-level club. You know, they've not had any consistency over the decade since Ferguson left. So filling Klopp's boots was always going to be an impossible task, but the fact it's kind of come out of the blue has made it even more impossible. And add to that the fact that Liverpool themselves as a squad and as a staff structure are kind of at a crossroads already before that. Liverpool are looking at absolute wholesale changes in the summer, because Salah is out of contract as of summer 2025 and is quite expected to probably go to Saudi this summer, or at least be tempted. Van Dijk isn't getting any younger. He's in his 30s now, and he's also out of contract next summer. So he could look at this scenario and be like, well, Klopp's gone, Salah's probably gone, what's there left for me? I could go somewhere else and still have a bash at a league title in, you know, in Spain or in Germany or whatever. Trent is also out of contract at the same time. There are a lot of big players who have big question marks about them. And the fact that Klopp is leaving and Liverpool are in this kind of transitional period puts even bigger question marks over whether they just go, you know what, it was great while it lasted, but the band's done, the band's broken up, and I don't have an infinite amount of years left in my career. So that means, realistically, Liverpool are at risk of losing. Well, they're losing Klopp, obviously. They're at risk of losing Salah. They probably will, their best player. They're at risk of losing Van Dijk, and I assume they will if you can't promise him like a guaranteed good project that is functional and competitive for the next 3 years. Because again, he doesn't have the years left in him to compete at the top level. And then you could also, realistically, and probably this is the least likely to happen, but you could lose your best academy product and a really good, useful, creative utility player in Trent. And then that doesn't even cover the fact that they still have all the issues they have this season with, you know, no defensive midfielder. They've got questionable depth at centre-back. All of this is coming kind of into this perfect storm of uncertainty. And yeah, it's like, if I was a Liverpool fan, I would be sitting there thinking, we're top of the league, we could win the league this year, and we're not playing the same way or necessarily as well as previous years, but like, if we get another Premier League title, who cares? And then all of a sudden you look towards next year and beyond and you're like, okay, this doesn't look quite as fruitful. This season could be fine, but after that, this could be a real multi-year transition period for Liverpool. So like you say, it's kind of impossible to know where they go, what they do, how they navigate this, because based on all of the unknowns, based on all of the kind of multiple permutations, multiple directions you could go with the squad, anything could really happen. And it's really, really difficult to see them not fucking up at least one or multiple of those decisions, which then ultimately means they will get worse for a at least temporary period of time. But like I said about Wenger, post-Wenger Arsenal, post-Ferguson United, unfortunately, Liverpool seem like they're kind of at that crossroads now. And it really could be a multi-year downturn for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're in this kind of strange spot in a way, because like they could end the season as champions and back in the Champions League. And the question is, what kind of a draw is Liverpool if they're in that position, but the manager there is, you know, way less of a kind of figurehead for the club than Klopp? Because there are very few people with the profile that Klopp has. There are very few people, you know, who are as good at managing as Klopp. But it feels like a few years ago, there were a bunch of people who were potential successors and who hadn't yet had their chance at a big club and maybe seen it gone awry. You know, I'm particularly thinking of someone like Nagelsmann. And now you look around and you think, well, there's exactly kind of one young manager who we're really, really talking about. You know, there are people like De Zerbi, and we'll talk a bit about him later. And there is Nagelsmann. You know, he's still on the cards. But really, Xabi Alonso seems to be like the guy everyone thinks that Liverpool have got to go and get. And there are other people, you know, there's like Farioli at Nice, who's 34 and has got Nice playing amazingly well. Like there are other options, but it doesn't feel like there's a next gen of just, you know, home runs waiting to be hit for Liverpool. It is quite an awkward time for them to do this transition, even though I think, despite all the issues that you've outlined in the squad, I do think the squad's in pretty good shape. Like, even if you lose Salah, you've still got a front line, you know, with Szoboszlai and Nunez and Jota and Diaz, plus obviously Trent. Like, it's still pretty good.
Yeah, it's not bad.
It's just, it's not, the backroom staff isn't elite anymore.
Yeah.
And the playing talent might be on the path away to from elite or on the path to it. You don't quite know necessarily. It depends. You know, if Trent and Van Dijk go, then suddenly it's a very different picture. And if the manager also takes a small step back and is not, you know, really, really good, with the state of the Premier League right now, that's enough to see you drop several places. So, I mean, it feels like inevitably this conversation has to kind of focus on Xabi Alonso, because it's kind of advantageous, you'd assume, that the highest profile young manager in the world also happens to be an ex-midfielder from Liverpool. But I don't know. You look at the situation at Leverkusen and you kind of think, well, we don't necessarily know what Alonso is outside Leverkusen. Is what we see in Germany the kind of manager he's always going to be, or is he playing that way because of his talent? And then the question is, does that style of playing work for Liverpool? So I don't know, what's your take on Xabi Alonso? Because I feel like you have a sort of football romantic streak in you, which would probably make you mildly pro.
I mean, I'm kind of on the fence about it. So I think while I do have a football romantic streak in me, I also have a very soft spot for hot boy footballers, which Xabi Alonso absolutely is. So big pro in that regard. But in romantic terms for Liverpool, like you say, he's like a club legend. He won the Champions League with him back in 2005. He is one of the best performing managers this season. And it would be a really, really good romantic fit for them. And he's absolutely killed it with Leverkusen this season. You know, they're still undefeated. We spoke about Leverkusen, what, a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago?
Yeah, saying that, like, we talked about Villa as well.
Yeah, saying that, you know, should we be taking these guys seriously? And obviously we said, yes, these guys are a genuinely good team. Like, they're the only team that all of their numbers and all of the way they're playing and their stat, etc., it's them and Bayern and then everybody else. And at that stage, I was like, I really hope they can do it. And they've continued to do it. You know, in 29 games, they've scored 87 goals. They've averaged 3 goals a game this season.
Yeah, I mean,
That's absolutely outrageous.
Their form is absolutely unbelievable.
Absolutely outrageous. Unbeaten in 29 so far this season, all competitions. But so in all of those respects, former Liverpool player, hot boy, so far been a really, really good manager despite the kind of small sample size and relative inexperience or total inexperience at top level before this. That makes a lot of sense. And I get why he's being linked and I get why people are saying that. And, you know, if he's available, if he agrees to it, I wouldn't say no. I wouldn't say it's a bad thing. However, I do have significant reservations about the transition of him from Leverkusen to this Liverpool squad. So tactically, the way he plays at Leverkusen, I don't really believe is a very good fit for this squad at Liverpool. So Alonso is obviously a major, at least this season with Leverkusen, he's been a major possession manager. Like, he has built Leverkusen into a huge possession side. Leverkusen and Bayern are really the only two that stand alone in that regard in the Bundesliga, and then everybody else is like a completely different category. So to be able to kind of pull weight with Bayern shows the level of importance he places on things like possession, territory, field tilt, etc. And Liverpool's numbers, possession numbers, they're the lowest this year that they've been since like the 2015-16 season. And I think that's largely due to the fact that they have lost certain personnel, particularly in midfield. That means that they're not able to necessarily control games in the middle of the park as well as they used to be able to. You know, they've lost Henderson, they've lost Fabinho. Thiago, while he came back last week, I think that was his first game since like April. Like, he's unable to stay on the pitch for long periods of seasons. And then they've brought in players who, while are good in their own right, are different and have different skill sets that don't necessarily lend themselves to completely controlling the game through the midfield. So straight away, I question how well this Liverpool crop of players can implement a Xabi Alonso style super heavy possession based system. And like I say, you know, if he's free, sure. Or if he wants to, sure. But these are reservations that I have, because if you look at the way Leverkusen play, basically their kind of modus operandi is they play slow and short and through the lines.
They're the least direct team in Germany.
Yeah. So like, which
with a Tuchel Bayern team there is crazy.
That's a really good point as well. Yeah. Like, they are super slow. They are super measured. They play really short balls and they just work the ball up the pitch through the lines, and that takes a huge amount of like intricate passing. Liverpool, on the other hand, this season have pretty much been the exact opposite. They've been fast and they've been direct. So I'm not saying that Xabi Alonso will come in and copy and paste his system from Leverkusen to Liverpool, nor am I saying that Liverpool players can only play fast and direct. I'm just saying that there is something there that needs to give, and that there's a real transition period that needs to happen and to adapt in a very unsure time already at Liverpool. Like, if Alonso played fast, direct football, you'd be like, okay, that makes sense, because that's one less thing you need to worry about. We're going to continue playing this way, just with new parts. But now we've got new parts, we're also playing a new system, but we've still got all the old parts that need to adapt to this new system, and everything's new. So, yeah, I mean, that's my biggest concern. Like, when
I agree with us.
When I looked at the... But basically what I wanted to see when I looked at like statistics and data was what volume of passing is Alonso's system relying on their midfielders doing. So I didn't want to look at the quality of those players. I didn't want to look at how good they were creatively. I just wanted to look how involved are they in a team's possession. Basically, how often are they in the ball? And the one thing I wanted to look at was pretty much volume of passing. So how many passes are you attempting per game or across a season? And unsurprisingly, Granit Xhaka is by far and away the leader of the Bundesliga in terms of most attempted passes. So he's attempted over 2,100 passes this season, with also, fair play to him, 90%+ accuracy. But that is over 500 more than second place. So second place is like 1,600 something. He's got 2,100.
Oh,
and
God.
Of the top 20 passers for volume, so just the top 20 players who have attempted the most passes in the Bundesliga, 15 are defenders and 5 are midfielders. Of those 5 midfielders, 4 of them play for Leverkusen. So what that tells me is basically Alonso's system means your midfielders are going to have to be on the ball a ton and make a ton of passes, and that's how his system works. And if you watch Leverkusen play, that's absolutely true. My hesitation with that at Liverpool is that I think they've lost pretty much all of the players that are best at doing that, and I question, based on the current squad they have, they could do it, but I don't think they can do it anywhere near as well as they would need to be a genuine title contender team. So those are like some of the bigger concerns I suppose I have in how Alonso fits with this Liverpool squad. And
yeah,
I do, I'm not saying it won't work, and maybe it will work, and there will obviously be concessions made on both sides in terms of the how Liverpool play currently and how Alonso plays with Leverkusen, but I think it's far more complicated than just being like, Alonso has done great at Leverkusen and he used to play for Liverpool, get him in and we'll be grand.
Mm.
I think it's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with this. And I think even if we weren't talking about like a hyper-possession manager, I do think Liverpool are in a weird moment. Like, to put some numbers on what you were talking about before, in the 21-22 season, which was the last time Liverpool were kind of like, you know, over 90 points, like title-winning quality, their three most used midfielders were Hendo, Fabinho and Thiago. And those guys were completing 65, 53 and 79 passes respectively. Well, now the top three most used midfielders at Liverpool, Szoboszlai, McAllister and Jones, are on 54, that compares to 65, 61, that compares to 53, so that one's, you know, up. We could rejig these, and 79 compared to 51. So everybody in there is fairly similar, and it's a drop-off across the board. So, you know, if you looked at it and you were like, right, Thiago comes in, like, say Thiago was never injured, and this was just a rare blip in his career, and he was going to come in and be fit for a season, I wouldn't worry as much. But they need this deep midfielder. They need this player regardless, because these quick transitions are very unusual for a top side. It is really rare for a top team to be playing this way. Like, on the analyst, you can obviously see how quickly teams move forward, and they move forward at 1.95 metres per second, which is the third fastest in the league. What we normally see, obviously, are the bad teams moving forward quickly. They're like, we don't get a lot of the ball, so when we get it, we hoof it long. You know, we've got a big guy up front, we try and knock it down. City are the slowest team in the league. Arsenal are the third slowest. Even a team like Newcastle, who you think of as quite, you know, quite direct and quite, you know, willing to play risky passes. They're not like a possession team in the way the others are. They're in the bottom seven for this metric. So the fact that Liverpool are in the top three shows that, I think, Klopp looked at his talent and thought, this is the only way I've got to maximise these guys this season. We cannot play like keep ball without Henderson, without Fabinho and without Thiago. Like, we just can't do it. So we're going to have to do quick transitions. And you can even see it in the attackers as well. You know, when you had Mane there, Mane was their worst attacking passer when you had that, you know, that kind of famous front three. And he was at 75% lifetime pass accuracy. Well, Hakpo's at 70%. Darwin Nunez's career pass accuracy is 65%. Yeah. So it's not just in midfield. It's up front as well. And when Van Dijk goes, which at some stage he will, you know, he can stay, but he will slowly lose pace and you'll have to work around that. Slowly you are going to see this downtick in a lot of areas. And it doesn't take a lot. Teams when they have these downtick in areas, they don't tend to just keep getting slightly, slightly worse. Yeah. They tend to get slightly worse, and then way worse. Yeah. Because suddenly teams are able to just press them and break up their play a little bit more, and they don't have the edges they used to have. And similarly, if we see someone like Robertson start to get injured more, you know, like, there's a real... They had plus passers in so many positions, and now they might go to guys who are average. They might even go in some positions to guys who are below average. So I think they obviously need a new Thiago. I also think Curtis Jones playing more would help. If they were to keep Salah, whoever comes in could play Salah and Diaz with Nunez, which would give you, you know, more ball security across the board. But it's not just Alonso who's going to want to do this. I think if you want to win the league consistently, you know, not just like this season with Mo Salah still like being one of the best players in the league, if you want to create the juggernaut that Klopp did, you do kind of need to be a 60% possession side. You do need to do it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise teams are going to say, well, okay, we'll just hold the ball until you come and get it off us. Or we will let you have the ball, you know, and we won't really contest it. We won't get out of our shape. Like, you have to be proactive. So I don't know. There's a part of me that thinks Alonso is clearly good. I doubt, while I think he is probably a possession coach overall, I think the squad is probably okay and he could come in and sign two midfielders and it would be good enough. Mm-hmm. And you muddle through till the next summer and you get another couple of guys and slowly, slowly, slowly you become an Alonso team. But I think, you know, a lot of these guys on the list are very similar. Like, De Zerbi, I think, is actually quite similar, even though he's maybe a bit more of a direct guy and perhaps a better fit for the talent. I think
Liverpool still a big pass number three midfield as well.
Yeah, I think Liverpool have to interview him. I think they have to interview De Zerbi. They're obviously going to look at Nagelsmann. I think, you know, and I know that Michael Cayley and Michael Goodman have been talking about this, so I don't want to go on about it, but they should interview Thomas Frank.
Yeah.
He's a really smart, versatile coach. Again, the one concern is not much of a possession coach, but he has played more of a possession style in the Championship, obviously. And I just think he's an intelligent manager who is okay with the squad construction being out of his hands because the guys behind the scenes are going to do it. And there's a lot to be said for that. You know, Liverpool probably should also consider, though they've said they're going to leave with Klopp, they should consider the assistance to Klopp. You know, obviously, Pepijn Lijnders has been a guy who, like, people have always talked about as a potential successor.
Mm.
It's kind of, I don't know if Liverpool would give him that job, but at some stage, like, and this is probably that stage, he either needs to say, I'm going to be a career number two, or I'm going to be the guy. So those to me are kind of like people who should be considered. I think Zidane should be considered if his English is good enough, which again is a kind of a big open question. Nagelsmann would make some sense because Nagelsmann is young enough that if he came to your interview and he was like, I've learned from my mistakes at Bayern and up till now I've been a really attacking coach, but I do think that I've learned some lessons defensively, you know, that would be understandable. You know, if you hire a 60-year-old, they probably haven't got that much room to improve. Whereas if you hire like a 35-year-old or however old Nagelsmann is now, and he says, I've got like 30 years of my career ahead of me, then yeah, you think this is somebody we can actually grow with. And if we give him the right talent, we can get something out of him. Plus, you know, I think he was better at Bayern than he was given credit for. They were second by a point when he left. They had the best underlying numbers in the league. And people saying, you know, well, oh, he failed at Bayern, so should he come to Liverpool? What position was Klopp in when they yeah, hired him? Like, Klopp had, like, quote-unquote, flunked out of Dortmund when, again, their underlying numbers were a lot better than their performance. Zidane, just a smart coach with big reach. You know, one of the few yeah, guys you could get who will say, I will play in the way that the talent dictates, mm, I will make it work, and who also would have the draw yeah, that someone like Klopp would have. You know, like
the only one was superstar status, really.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm not saying it was ever going to happen, but the last couple of years, people have been saying, there have been rumours about Liverpool wanting Mbappe. And it's a testament to the way that Klopp has restored that club that you thought, okay, it would be surprising, but it wouldn't be like totally ridiculous if Mbappe went there. Like, they've been in three Champions League finals, they've won the league, they play amazing football.
It'd be a bit ridiculous, but
sure, but at the point, you know, when you were like, okay, Real Madrid are coached by, you know, Zidane has just come back to Real Madrid, or Ancelotti was just about to go back to Real Madrid. PSG at the time were a mess. Bayern were messing about with Flick and Nagelsmann. Like, City obviously didn't really seem like they were kind of on the cards. It was, you could look at them at that point and say, maybe Liverpool are a sensible choice for him. Like, he'll play great football, he'll score a ton of goals, he'll probably win things.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That would have been an interesting one. That would be an interesting one to me. My dream coach, though, because I do have a dream coach,
mm-hmm,
is Luciano Spalletti. And I really think this is quite a difficult one because he's 64.
Yeah.
So, like, older than you expect.
After the big spiel you give about Nagelsmann being young.
Well, yeah, but I think Spalletti's a better coach than Nagelsmann right now. And certainly he's a better fit for the talent. The problem is he, like Nagelsmann, is not going to be available immediately because of the Euros. Like, he's managing Italy. But I do think that the football he played at Roma and at Napoli has a sort of DNA connection with Liverpool football. They're obviously a really attacking side. They are perfectly happy doing quick transitions, playing through their wingers. They have fullbacks who are super involved in possession. They let their defenders really stride forward. Last year, incredible attack, obviously. Best attack in Italy. Also had the best defence. And you could easily see how, if Spalletti came in, Salah is your Kvicha, Nunez is your Osimhen, Van Dijk is your Kim, Szoboszlai is your Zielinski. Like, you can see how his style of football would map onto that squad with guys who are by no means downgrades on the people yeah, he had at Napoli. And even if you got him in and he said, I'm going to do 4 or 5 years here, like, I'm not going to give you like nearly a decade, I think that would probably be worth it.
Mid-70s in a decade.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like Italian Roy Hodgson in a decade. But given that I don't think the managerial market is all that great, sometimes the sensible thing is get somebody in who will keep us competitive now, because I do think Spalletti would keep them competitive, especially if Pep leaves in the next couple of years. And in a couple of years, when there's a good managerial market, you say to Spalletti, okay, maybe we're going to break our contract a year early. Like, have a break contract, have a contract break clause at the end of every year he's there, and just say to him at the end, we're going to pay you $5 million because X person has become available.
Sure.
And we want to get them in. You know, like, if Alonso doesn't want to come, then you can say to Spalletti, we want to get you in on a four-year contract. And if Alonso becomes available in 2 years, you're like, okay, bye Spalletti, in comes Alonso. And also, I do think, you know, when Arsenal hired Arteta, in a way, the expectations of playing fun Wenger ball had completely, like, disappeared. Like, mm-hmm. the football was so dull under Emery. Not just bad, but dull.
Yeah.
That everyone was kind of like, we just need to get good however we get good. And it took ages, but they did slowly get good. And Man United, similarly, you know, it's just like, we just need to be competent and play a recognisable style and, like, seem like we're a club that has people whose fucking brains are attached to their spinal columns, like, running us. Whereas Liverpool, at this point, you know, like, they're going to demand to be entertained. They have played, I would argue, the most entertaining football in the world for a decade now, almost. I enjoyed... Like, Liverpool at their best, I think, was the most enjoyable football I've seen almost ever. Like, it was incredible stuff. And Spalletti's going to keep that atmosphere. And I do think you need somebody who feels like they have the, you know, the kind of personality and the charisma to step into Klopp's shoes. Because I don't think you can just go and get, like, this just sounds like a dig. But can you imagine Erik ten Hag at Anfield as Liverpool manager? I just can't. I just don't think he's got the personality to, like, carry the weight of that stadium. I know this sounds like ridiculous stuff, but the manager of Liverpool, in my opinion, should feel like the king of Anfield, you know? And Klopp had that. Whoever comes in after him is going to have enormous shoes to fill in that regard.
I think that's the biggest problem. They're not going to be able to fill those shoes. And I guess it's who is best placed to not necessarily fill the shoes, but... It's damaged limitations at this point. And also, I think...
But don't you think that there's a... But don't you think if you said, like, Liverpool, like, this city which gets, like, relentlessly shit-talked by Southerners in the UK and, like, hadn't won a title in 30 years and Klopp came in and, like, built them back into a superpower and they won their first title, Spalletti, like, goes to Napoli. Like, Naples, the most traduced city in Italy, like, constantly talked down about. Like, it's... disgraceful, really, the way that Napoli is talked about by, you know, people in northern Italy, hadn't won the title in 30 years. And Spalletti comes along and changes it and doesn't just win the title, you know, playing, like, negative football. He wins the title playing the best, some of the best football in Europe. Like, I don't know. I think that there's that underdog thing and that, like, us against the world thing. Spalletti has lived that. And it might be... a slightly less intense version of that he'd get at Liverpool, which might make him happy. You know, a lot of the positives of managing Napoli without, like, quite the same level of insanity, where people, like, nick your car so you can't leave the city, that kind of thing. Like,
actually, I think they nicked the steering. Oh, no, they nicked his car and gave his steering wheel back. That's what it was, after he won the title. But that's outrageous.
So I don't know. Like, that to me is, like, stylistically, personality-wise, like, there's a lot of romance, I think, to that as a choice. But also, I think... on a football level, it makes sense if you can't get the guy who you think is the guy. And we're all just assuming that Liverpool think Xabi Alonso is the guy because Leverkusen are in a title race and because he used to manage them. But for all we know, whoever comes in as sporting director, because obviously as well, that's actually the biggest gap that they have to fill, the next sporting director of Liverpool, whoever comes in as sporting director has to see Alonso as the guy. Because if they don't, it doesn't matter how well he does with Leverkusen. It doesn't matter if Leverkusen win the title for the first time in their history under him. If he doesn't think that the way the squad's going aligns with the kind of football that Alonso's going to play, Liverpool won't go for him. They're not Chelsea. They're not just going to get, like, the next best manager and spend hundreds of millions of pounds reshaping the squad the way that guy wants. Like, Liverpool, I think, have learned not to do that.
I think there are a lot of very important and telling conversations to be had in the next few months, basically to decide where the club will be squad-wise at the start of next season or the season after. And then subsequently, the manager will be, decision will be made on that, because the club will definitely be having conversations with players like Salah and Van Dijk and Trent, who are about to come out of contract next summer. So if they're going to sell them, they're going to sell them. They've got to sell them this summer for money. If, you know, if they have a conversation and Van Dijk says, I think the project's over, I want something new, I'm not going to be signing a new contract, that means you need to sell him in the summer. So if you have that plus Salah and plus Trent, then maybe that changes the landscape enough to maybe question your initial choice for manager. There are so many unknowns, so many things up in the air. The backroom staff, like the best Liverpool teams were built by Klopp and Michael Edwards. Both, like, yeah. Michael Edwards has been gone since mid-22. Klopp's now gone. And also, I think part of the reason Klopp's going is because he's pretty much burnt himself out, because he's covered so much of Liverpool since Edwards has left. Like, you know, so there's no telling how big the holes are in Liverpool's backroom and where responsibility lies and who's going to make those decisions. So I think sporting director's huge. I think the conversations you have with big players, really senior players, and their kind of contract status and where they see their Liverpool career going, if it's ending or if they're going to extend. And after all that, then I think you can make a more educated decision on what manager to go for. But I just don't think it's as easy as being like, Alonso's good, he used to play for Liverpool, let's go get him. I think they have to be far smarter than that.
I agree. But okay then, let's assume you're the sporting director.
Yeah.
The manager's on the market, given the squad, who are you going for?
Liverpool were obviously in big for DMs last year and got none. If you can promise me another season out of Van Dijk and at least one absolutely lights out top quality defensive midfielder, I'm fine with Alonso. Even if you lose Salah, I think you can make, like, you can never replace Salah, but you can replace him in the aggregate. And it, not that Alonso would copy and paste his style from Leverkusen, even if he did, it doesn't necessarily lend itself into maximising Salah's output, because Salah would need to come deeper and narrower to get more involved in the game. And I don't think that would be detrimental to his output, in my opinion. So while that would be a huge loss, the money you would get from him and the way you could replace him in the aggregate, if you get a big pass number DM that can be metronomic in that midfield, and you can definitely have Van Dijk for another season at least, plus Trent, I think there's enough progressive passers in that team to work in a possession-based Alonso style. If that's a no and you lose too many parts of that, to be honest, I have no idea. I honestly have no, because that's just a full wholesale change. Like, that's got to be a top-down decision of what are Liverpool 2.0 going to be like in, what are Liverpool going to be in 2027? That's a full rebuild. And then once you decide how you want to play, I suppose you go out and get that. Maybe Spurry works in the short term then. But again, you don't have him until, like, what? Just as the season starts, like a couple of weeks
pretty
before.
Pretty much.
But again, if you're then committing to a full rebuild, or at least the start of a full rebuild, I suppose you're kind of throwing caution to the wind, and you want somebody in short term to as a stopgap, so you can refresh the squad and then go for potentially, I suppose, Nagelsmann then actually as well. Same scenario as Spalletti, but he's young. You can grow with him. A squad can grow with him. He can be there for 8 to 10 years and have the time to build the squad out. So, okay. If most of the big players stay, I'd be happy with Alonso as long as he's given the backing to get a big DM that can kind of control a game and carry possession responsibility. If multiple parts of their squad are leaving, I would take a risk on Nagelsmann and just rebuild the squad around them.
Wowza. I would go Alonso. You know, despite all the kind of reservations, I do think that, like, a couple of midfielders and you should be fine. I think that he's probably versatile enough that he could get around it without the perfect talent. It's not like the guys he has at Leverkusen are, like, all the best in their position in the world. Like, he's got loads of talent there, but
Granit Xhaka was basically half out of the Premier League.
And they're still performing at, like, a much, much higher level than, like, you'd expect to be, like, keeping pace with Bayern. It's crazy. You know, there's a chance he's going to be the best manager in the world one day. So I think you've got to go for it. And your squad is better than most big club squads have been when they've been inherited by the guy after the guy. Like, United's squad was terrible. Arsenal's squad was terrible.
Yeah.
Like, Chelsea always seem to be in a disaster zone, even though they've got loads of talent. Like, Spurs are on the downswing. Like, Liverpool are in a pretty good spot. They've got a bunch of young, intelligent, quite versatile players. I think that you go and get Alonso. But if he doesn't come, if he won't come, I think you get Spalletti. Because you, what you could do if you made the Spalletti decision early is you get him in before the end of the season. You get him in to take a look at the players, you know, like you get him talking to Klopp about the transition. Then he goes away and does the Euros and he comes back ready to start the season. And yeah, it's not ideal, but you don't hire a manager for like the first 3 months after they start. You hire a manager for multiple seasons. So that would be my vague take. But I don't know, man, like it really does feel like next season will be a different world. Like after Arsenal beat Liverpool, absolutely battered the fuck out of Liverpool at the Emirates the other day. after that happened, just like fucking destroyed them. They were crap. Yeah. I thought, oh, we're never gonna play Klopp's Liverpool again.
Yeah.
And that did feel good, like I said, but it was very, very strange. It was very strange. So that's our take on Liverpool. After all that talk, we're like, I don't know if this is going to suit Alonso's style of football. We're both like, yeah, I'd hire Xabi Alonso. Great. Let's move on to the burn book. Okay, burn book time. Pete, do you want to start? If so, where would you like to start?
I would love to start. And where I'm going to start is I'm going to put something in the burn book. And what I'm going to put in the burn book might be a little bit controversial. So only very slightly. What I'm going to put in the burn book are dogs in the office. I love dogs. I love animals. I've always loved animals. We currently don't have a dog just because we don't have the lifestyle to support a dog in that. Like, it wouldn't be fair. We're out of the house too much, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we have considered it and we've come to the decision that it wouldn't be fair on a dog. So we are very animal conscious people. And I love dogs. But in this kind of post-COVID business world with Gen Z and millennial people who have got dogs probably during lockdown or at some point as companions and are now like physically incapable of leaving their dogs for any period of time, and they so much so that like the dog itself has like huge separation anxiety, means that they all bring them to the office, and anytime you go into the office there's like seven dogs just like bounding about on the floor, and like being dogs. Like, it's not the dog's fault. It's just like one dog in the office was a rarity pre-COVID. It was like, oh, you brought your dog in, sure, like I understand something probably came up. This wasn't planned. Or you were just like, oh fuck it, it'll be get him out of the house, whatever. Fine. One dog, completely rare. Not a like permanent fixture in the office. Now it's just out of hand. Now it's just like multiple people are bringing, it's like Battersea Cats and Dogs Home. Multiple people are bringing their dogs into the office. They're bringing them in every day as well. So people are coming in 3 days a week. They're bringing their dogs in 3 days a week. And it's just chaos. They're just running about. They're like barking. They're just being generally like en masse, like as a collective, just annoying. And I love dogs, but I'm like, we're fucking working here. Like, can we just maybe not do this? And also, maybe you should teach your dog boundaries so much so that they can be left at home for like 4 hours at a time, and then you get a dog walker in at lunchtime. Breaks up their day. And it's like, your dog, I understand that you love your dog and your dog is a huge part of your life. I completely understand that and support that. But you need to be able to leave it for like an afternoon. It does need to be by your side the whole time. And there are too many people bringing dogs in the office these days.
I completely agree with this. And also, like, training your dog is good for your dog. Like, your dog's a pack animal. Like, your dog, like, children like boundaries and so do animals. Like, they actually make them secure.
Yeah.
You know, the dog that's like dragging somebody along on the walk is not like having the time of its life.
No.
But this is generally my issue. I don't think people train their dogs. Look, I like dogs. I like them fine. I don't really care that much. Like, I don't care that much about animals. Like, I like dogs though. They're nice. But what I find crazy. Yeah. But what I find crazy is that, like, how often I'm obliged to interact with an animal where I didn't choose to interact with them. So, for example, you know, quite often I'll be in the park or whatever and a dog will run over and like literally jump up on me and like get me muddy or something.
Yeah.
And this happens all the time. Or like they come over and they jump up at my kid and everyone always comes over and they're like, oh, she's really friendly. And I'm like, it's not that I think your dog's not friendly. Like, it's going to kill my child. It's the fact that like my child has no say in it because your dog is already here doing it.
It also totally could as well. And every week you see a headline at the minute being like, person mauled by dog.
And I just think, I don't make you interact with my kid. Like, And I think that, and also it's kind of like, you know, if you go on social media or whatever, there are loads of people who kind of talk about how much they hate kids in public spaces. Yeah. You know, like, why is this kid on the plane? Like, I don't want to talk to your kid. Like, I'm child free by choice, blah, 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 all this shit. And it's kind of like a completely fine thing to say, like, I don't like kids, I'm not interested in kids. But if someone's like, I'm not interested in your fucking dog. Like, I didn't ask to meet your dog today. Some days I want to meet a dog. Some days I don't. I should have the choice.
Yeah.
But I don't because you haven't trained your fucking dog. Like, I do find that really strange. Like, when a dog comes up and jumps up at me, I'm just like, I didn't like consent to this interaction just by leaving my house. Like, I should be allowed to walk through a public place without exactly. some fucking animal like getting mud all over me just because somebody can't be asked to train it. And I just find that really, really strange. And I think it's just part of the same thing. Like, there are a lot of people who think of themselves as animal lovers, but then they go and get, like, you know, a pug or something, which is definitely, you know, which...
It doesn't have a good life, does it?
Yeah. Well, in what sense has a pug... You know, I know, we know, like, vegans, for example, who will talk to you about, like, how dairy cows are bred to produce more milk and chickens have been, like, engineered so that they have more, like, meat on the bone. And then yeah. you're like, you have a fucking, like, cockapoo. Like, that is not... It's not a wolf that you found. Like, people... engineered those so that yeah. they could have the and cutest possible like docile pet. Like, I just don't understand. So it's just like, so you're an animal lover, are you? Where you have your own little like GM freak. I don't know, I just, that kind of stuff feels strange to me. But it's more that I just think I don't like that this is happening to me without me saying I'm okay with it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
At least if somebody comes up and starts talking to me, I could say fuck off, I don't want to talk to you. And if they carry on, I can like hit them, or I can report them for harassment. Whereas if somebody's dog comes up, I'm like obliged to stand there while they're like, oh, he's really friendly. And I'm like, bro, I literally don't care. Like, yeah. I've got a place to be. Like, all right. Like, I'm sure he isn't violent. I'm not like scared he's going to eat me. I just don't want this to be my day. So yeah, hard agree with this. Hard agree. And if you're bringing your... Imagine if I brought my kid into the office. Like, everyone would be like, why is there a baby here? Why is it making noise? Why is it shitting? And you're like, dogs literally came into our former company and shat on the floor.
Yeah. But in the same thing with the kid, like, imagine it was six kids all at, like, toddler age. That would be chaos. That would, like, no, like, they would be the most distracting thing ever in the office. And I fully agree with everything you said. And the worst thing about the office is that your employer is forcing you to be there. Or generally, like, your employer is telling you to be in, like, these 3 days. So you don't really have the choice to come into the office or not. You're like, well, it's an office day, so I need to go in. You're then met with a multitude of dogs, all being like disruptive and distracting. It's yeah, like, well, I can't agreed. Get away from them because I either need to break the rules to get away from them, or you should give me the autonomy to choose to not come in, at which point you will never see me again other than on a screen, which I'm fine
the dream.
With. I fully support all dogs in the office if I can go fully remote again.
I don't care what they do in the office if I can get a remote. I don't care if there's like a carbon monoxide leak. Like, it just doesn't bother me.
Would welcome.
Okay, hard agree with this. Hard agree. What I'm putting in the burn book, get ready with me.
Okay.
Done with it. Look, I like seeing people's outfits online, but the get ready with me trend, I mean, it's more than a trend, but like whatever, format is just so boring and annoying at this point. And I see people doing it who are just like literally putting on like a t-shirt and jeans. I see so many people there like, get ready with me. And I'm like, that's a hoodie and a jumper. And the fact that hoodie, that's a hoodie and trousers. And the fact that hoodie was like 150 quid doesn't make this a fit. Like,
yeah,
you're just wearing Sambas and jeans and a hoodie. Like, go the
and
fuck
then
away.
Like a crossbody bag.
Yeah. And the whole thing is so obnoxiously self-involved as well. So, I mean, it's also completely aesthetically like moribund, in that you see people, you know, it's always the same shot. Someone holds one end of a belt and like lets it unroll, you know, or like they turn around at the beginning of the video and they like pull their shirt over their head. Like
the first frame is them always half naked.
The first frame is them taking off the outfit they're already wearing so they can start putting on the outfit they're going to wear.
Starts as a thirst trap.
It's so stupid. Yeah, and then at the end, you know, they stand there and they do like two or three little poses in that three-quarter position, like staring off into the distance, like they're, you know, waiting in queue at a coffee shop, assuming that they're about to get model talent scouted. Like, and that's how they all think. And also, I just think half of you dress like shit. Like, I don't need to see like Daniel Simmons do it. He's like a weird fucking AI doll, and I hate his clothes. I hate the way he dresses. Like, there are so many people like this where I think, I get that you have a distinctive style or whatever, or I get that you spend a lot of money on clothes, but if you're going to do a get ready with me, I sort of think that's like, you know, pointing to the stands. You know, you're like, I expect to see a hell of an outfit at the end of this. And when at the end of it, I'm like, oh, it's a dress and boots that you've put on. Or it's like, it's a shirt and high-waisted trousers and loafers. Is that a fit? Like, it's just some fucking clothes, man. So I don't know. I just think that this is, it's absolutely everywhere. It's intensely annoying. Everyone who does it clearly thinks that they're a star.
Yeah.
It just pissed me off. I don't need it anymore. Just put up a picture of your outfit. Yeah. I don't need to see the fucking video of you, like, you know, pulling off your outfit and you turn around. So it's like, oh, I wonder if he's got a six pack. Oh, like, I can't see her tits. You know, like, it's kind of doing that where it's just like, oh, what would you be seeing if you were on the other side?
You're your stick.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah. Oh, what would you be seeing? Like, oh, I'm wearing my very tight Calvin Kleins. Yeah. And you're just like, this is just start an OnlyFans. Like, be honest. This is boring. Oh,
I'm going to pull on my trousers, but I'm going to turn around while I do it. And I'm wearing a thong. Just that's just how I get dressed.
Yeah, it's great. Just annoying, man. It's like, are you telling yourself that, like, you're a popular content creator because you're great at making content? Like, you know that you're a popular content creator because you're hot.
Yeah.
Like, you know it. These people must know. Like, do they really think I'm amazing at dressing? Like, no, you're just a hot guy with a six pack. Like, yeah. Okay.
You're the people clothes are built for, essentially, like, in terms of how they're cut and how they fall.
Yeah.
And I think when they're smaller names, or like the ones who become successful, when they first started out, it was more interesting because they were doing more inventive stuff with lower budgets. But the bigger they become, all you really then see is like, okay, yeah, your outfit, while it might not be like groundbreaking, you look good in it. But the reason you look good in it is because, one, you're a hot person, and two, you're now so big that you're either rich enough or you get given all these clothes that are now like thousands and thousands of, you're wearing like £3,000 worth of clothes in one outfit. So yes, of course your t-shirt and your trousers and jacket are going to look better than mine because my version is 10% of the price.
Yes.
Because I'm not going to spend £3,000 on an Acne jacket.
Yeah.
Much as I wish I could, I'm just not going to.
Yeah, this, what I'm looking at now is like the lookbook.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not looking at a person who's putting an outfit together. I'm looking at the lookbook, and like that's all well and good, but it's like a totally different thing. That's why the fashion people I do follow are people who thrift all their clothes, or who say, you know, I'm particularly short, or like whatever it is, you know, like there's some physical thing where they're like, I dress for my body type, and it's interesting seeing how people approach that, as opposed to I'm fucking 6'2", I'm incredibly good looking, I've got broad shoulders and a small waist, and I just put on some shit today because I look like a Ralph Lauren model. Like, I'm not impressed. So anyway, I just think it's an annoying format for people who fundamentally just want to post thirst traps and don't have the balls to do that.
Agreed. Right.
What are you taking out?
What I'm taking out of the burn book this week is the Six Nations. Big, big fan of the Six Nations. You're a rugby boy, so I assume you support this.
No, not really.
No, really? Great, thanks. But yeah, no, for me, Six Nations is one of the best sporting tournaments going. A truly elite sporting tournament. And I think that for multiple reasons. Like, one, I'm a big fan of rugby in general. And I do get that the fans get ripped for, like, you know, like the jeans and shoes guys. Mm-hmm. Your blue stonewashed jeans with like tan shoes or boots. And like you all wear like chaufflets and stuff. I get that. And it's, there is kind of a large amount of legitimacy to that. But in many ways, I prefer that to like a lot of Stone Island wearing football fans who want to like fight each other. What I love about rugby is that you can sit in the same stand as an opposition and that'd be absolutely fine because you're an adult in control of your emotions versus the football fans who need to be separated by like police cordon.
Well, and so, of course, you all vote Conservative. So, you know, you've all got a lot in common.
You also like rugby, Patrick.
I don't really anymore. I liked playing rugby when I was young. because I was fat and it was one of the few sports that didn't shame me for that. They were like, have we got a job for you? But yeah, you know, I liked playing it, but now I'm just kind of like, whatever.
But outside of that, the Six Nations is great because it is a super digestible amount of sport. So there are only six teams. It's mm-hmm. spread over a number of weeks and all of the games happen at the weekend. So the World Cup football or like the Olympics or whatever, those are great. But after a week of having like three games a day, it gets very overstimulating. Like I'm thinking particularly about the Football World Cup, and it gets quite difficult to like muster up the willingness to like watch your third game of the day, which would put you over like 15 for the last 10 days or the last 7 days or whatever. And it all gets a bit saturated in those mega tournaments like the World, like Football World Cup. Whereas rugby, three games a week, Friday, Saturday or Sunday. So you're at the weekend. You don't need to like try and manufacture how to watch like England versus Panama at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday. Like they're going to be during, generally speaking, as a 9-to-5 worker, they're going to be during your social hours. And three games a week, and then you got 5 days rest until the next one. You've even got a break week in the middle of it. It's just a super digestible amount of sport that you can go to the pub, hammer some Guinness, watch some rugby, and then that's it for the next week. Like it's just such a good tournament, and Ireland are great at the minute, which is probably helping me mm-hmm. and my enjoyment. I think we were number one in the world. Didn't win the World Cup, so I think we're number two now. I think Springboks number one. But yeah, beat France away, first game, hardest game that we'll have. So not to jinx it, could be the first team to go back-to-back Grand Slams in history.
When you say we, what's the... How does that work?
Oh, okay. For those who can't see, I've just by chance had my Irish passport sitting on my desk, which is now being shown to Patrick. So... As per the Good Friday Agreement, I am granted dual England nationality. Normally. Pardon? Mm.
You support England normally, though.
For what? In what?
You know, football, like war.
Yeah, you know, actually, the war, yeah, sure. The only English team that I have any time for is England cricket. And that's because even though Ireland cricket have test status now, when I was growing up, Ireland cricket were fairly dire. And I like cricket. Sure. And there was literally nothing else. Like there wasn't, if you wanted to watch Test cricket and have any sort of like horse in the race, it was England or nobody. But yeah, I have dual nationality, Patrick. And Ireland, rugby specifically, is a full island team. There is no Northern Irish rugby team. So there are many, well, a handful of players from Ulster.
Well, that's kind of what I was asking. Yeah. Like, is it it's a unified Ireland?
Yeah. So national anthems wise, they play Ireland's Call, which is the unified anthem for the island of Ireland, which talks about like working together and being equals and that. But yeah, so players from Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland both play for Ireland rugby team.
Okay, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, I get it. Like watching sport at the weekend must be nice. you know, so having a few jars, watching the rugby, I get it. Like taunting the English. It's got a lot going for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. You know, talking about, you know, all the people you want to send to Rwanda, you know. Yeah, I just having a great time.
How tough your week's been in finance, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Like, just like your wife, you know, accidentally didn't wash your favourite Gino, all that kind of shit. All right.
Your trad wife.
What am I taking out of the burn book? Yeah, your trad wife. So, since the baby's been born, there's obviously a degree of shift work that happens between me and my wife. And I have the kind of first late shift at night, as you can tell by the fact that I'm holding a baby who is not asleep, by the way, which is quite troubling. And I was like, has she been awake this whole time? Yeah. She's been sneezing.
I've heard her sneezing, but I can't see her.
Here she is.
She's so tiny.
You're going to go to sleep. What do you think? Don't know. So I was like, I need something to watch. And something I'd never watched, but I saved it on my Sky Go, Band of Brothers. Had never got round to Band of Brothers. I don't know why. I just missed it years ago, and then like I never had it on DVD or anything. And so I thought, right, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch this. And I've been watching it holding the baby in the evenings, and I am having a great time. Like, it's not the quietest show to watch with a baby, You know, sure. Quite often, like, a shell goes off or something, and you think, I could have lived without that. But it's just great to watch a show that's just, like, clearly amazing. And I'm enjoying the evenings. I hold the baby for 2 to 3 hours while she sleeps, and we just have a great time together. I show her stuff about the Second World War. Also, this morning, I had a shift. I had an early, like, not that early, but I had a morning shift today, and turned on the TV, and what should be on but Lord of the Rings. And I was just like...
Which one? Are you Fellowship?
It was Return of the King, actually.
Okay.
And I was just like...
Longest one.
And I turned it on just as they were doing a big speech before the battle. And I was like, you are about to have a good time. you have no idea, but you're about to see some shit.
Yeah.
And so it's just been really nice. You know, it's nice bonding time. I hold my baby. We chat during the ad breaks. Well, I talk to her while she sleeps.
Yeah.
And then... we watch like a really harrowing World War II drama, but it's phenomenal. I knew it was going to be phenomenal. I just never got around to it. Yeah. Highly recommend.
I kind of think it sounds a little bit similar. There are obviously some very, very big differences, but it sounds a little bit similar to when you like lock in on a long haul flight and just start watching something, knowing that you're kind of just there and that's what you're doing because you're holding the baby and she's sleeping. Mm. It's not like you can get distracted or you can go do other shit. It's like you're just kind of locked in that position, largely for the next few hours, kind of like when you're in a long-haul fight and you're just like, well, I know I just don't really need to think about much else other than watching this and caring for my child while she sleeps. And then that's kind of it. Everything else just kind of falls into the ether, which is just like beautifully like mind-numbing and like relaxing almost.
Yeah, like when an episode finishes, I don't think, what will I watch next? Just the next episode comes on and I'm like, great. Like it all just rolls into one. It's like, I'm not spending any time wondering what to watch.
Yeah.
I'm not spending any time figuring out, you know, will Emma want to watch this too? I just put on what I want to watch and sit there holding a baby and she's really warm and she sleeps on me and it's great. Are you going to go to sleep? You keep yawning. Okay. So I think that brings us to the end of the Burn Book for this week. Thank you very much for your patience. Obviously, we weren't here last week, but if you are a subscriber, you will catch an extra episode over on the paid side. Head to patreon.com/PatrickVS, either to get access or to sign up. You can sign up for $6 a month and you will get 2 extra episodes. We really thank everybody who has signed up and we will catch you in a couple of weeks here on the public side too. Thanks so much. We'll see you later. Bye.